Okay. I was asked to address the following question. Okay. Can you address a topic that some people feel is controversial? Religion and therapy. Some people feel that that in the process of therapy, too much focus is put on the negative motivations driving one to act in a religious manner, such as guilt, shame, etc., but not enough attention is given to the underlying desire that a person has to connect with God. As a result, people may come out of therapy less religious than when they went in. Maybe you can tell us what your approach is and how you try and resolve both the negativity one may have towards religion, yet help preserve a lifestyle that is meaningful. Okay, so certainly Chazal do tell us, right, that there is an underlying desire that people have to be close to Hashem, as you know, Ritzeinenu Lasais Ritzeincha. It's actually an interesting verse from my grandfather, the Litzkarov, in the Sefer Zayin L'Taira on this week's Parsha Grada. I just noticed it today, I thought it really fits in. You know, the Medrash says that the reason why Moshe gave accounting for the money he spent on the Mishkan was because there were people who were accusing him of skimming off the top, getting rich on the on the taxpayer expense. So he asked an interesting question: how come you don't find that they asked for an accounting when they gave the gold for the eagle? When they gave Aaron the gold, doesn't say anywhere there that he gave an accounting for the use of the gold. And all that came out was a little eagle; it wasn't even a cow, right? So he says, because since every Jew inside wants to do what's right, so when they're giving money for the right thing, they talk about to make sure it goes all 100% of it goes for the right thing. But when they give for the wrong thing, subconsciously, they're happy if the guy skims off the top and it doesn't go for the eagle. That's why he didn't, it's this idea that really, deep down, we really want to do what's right. Okay, and the truth is, many patients, although they're not the ones that people complain about, but the many patients become more religious in a healthy way, and not necessarily superficially, but internally, more religious because they become healthier. Just recall one young fellow I worked with who was extremely perfect. He was like a top buck in his yeshiva, very, very good in learning, and was very perfectionistic. Eventually, he catches up with you because his anxiety level went so high that he barely could get through the day without medication. Okay, and what we discovered was that his father was a very intelligent person but did not have the opportunity to be learned. Perhaps he was about Shuva, I don't remember exactly, it was many years ago. But his father lived vicariously through his son. He was well-to-do, and a lot of the rabbis or yeshivas would come to raise money by him, and he would always talk about his brilliant son who was going to be the next Gadol Hadar. So, you know, he really felt a tremendous amount of pressure to please his father and bring his father and make his father proud. And became very competitive, and his whole learning was in order to show people and to be better than someone else. And because he was able to deal with this, it took a lot of work, but he got over it to a great extent. One of the ways he knew that he was getting somewhere is for the first time in his life, he chose a chavrusa based on who he would enjoy more learning with, not one that would make a bigger impression on other people that he got, you know, because he was very good in learning, so the top guys would want to learn with him. So he used to just think that his decision was based on who would get the best publicity. Oh, you know, who he got his chavrusa, shit, you know. And when he found that for the first time in his career in yeshiva, he actually chose a chavrusa he thought he would actually enjoy learning with, he realized he got healthier. So in many ways, he became more religious in that sense. And there was once a fellow who had an internet addiction looking at inappropriate things, and he went to speak to a Rav who dealt with these things and who was, you know, helped him. But after a while, the Rav realized that this had some deeper roots, and it turned out that he was very, very, his father was incredibly controlling, had a tremendous amount of resentment to his father for his incredibly controlling manner toward him, and was totally unaware of it. He had, like, repressed it completely. And through therapy, he became more assertive. He actually improved his relationship with his father because he, you know, his father, to his credit, you know, tried when he was confronted with it in a polite manner, did in fact try to change it. And he was, like, astonished that actually reduced his acting out behavior considerably. So, you know, many times a person, by becoming a healthier person, it does help a person actually be more religious in a healthier way. Okay, but then that's another question. Let's say that's not the case. Often it's not the situation. The person comes to therapy already with bitter feelings toward religion. Okay, so the question was, what about the natural feeling that a person has that he wants to be closer to Hashem? Okay, well, what happens is the guy's now 20 years old and he's showing up and it's certainly not apparent. He's like bitter against religion. What happened? Right? People forget sometimes. I get these comments all the time. You know, I don't know, he was fine until he went to therapy. I said, yeah, I got to apologize for kidnapping him off the street. He was perfectly fine. I just grabbed him in. He came to therapy for a reason. I remember many years ago I did consulting in nursing homes. And I remember the family would complain after the person would be in the nursing home for 2-3 years. They'll say, I don't know, she was fine till she came to the nursing home. Yeah, you wonder why in the world they came to the nursing home. I mean, that's why she wasn't fine. Then she's, you know, now she's 89, not 86. So, you know, so there's a reason why the person came to therapy. If he was perfectly comfortable and happy with his religion and felt his great desire to be closer to God, he probably wouldn't come to therapy. Now, a lot of times, even though the person's religiosity that he had is very often based on unhealthy things, right? So let's say if a person is learning purely to please other people, never really even develop an ability to learn for any internal reasons, you know, being perfectionistic, or escaping strong feelings of inadequacy. Sometimes there are kids who grew up not doing well academically, not doing well socially, or other type of problems that affected their self-esteem. At some point they realize that if they really get turned on to learning and really put all their titles into it, they'll increase their status. So it's an escape from something. It's not a pull to something. Right? Now, if you cure the person of his unhealthy motivations, at least superficially, it'll look like he got worse. Right? I remember I once was a very... very prestigious mashgiach that asked me to see this young man, and he had many serious issues in the family, and he started expressing his anger in the family more openly. So I once had a meeting with his mashgiach and the parents who were complaining about me, and they told this mashgiach, you know, he was fine until he went to therapy. So the mashgiach says, you can't sell that to me. I've been talking to him for months. He was very unfine and he was very angry. He just didn't have the guts to express it. Now he's expressing it. The same thing is true with religiosity, that sometimes that's, you know, it seems that way. In fact, this question troubled me when I first started many years ago in practice, and I also felt it was kind of disturbing. Somebody who used to go to shul, used to daven, is no longer davening. I actually asked a very chashuv paisik, you know, whether I should worry about it. Actually, I spoke to one place and one very frustrated rabbi, and they both told me the same answer. Just help him become normal. That's what you should worry about. Don't worry about the other things. Right? It's the same thing you have with your marriage counselors are often accused of causing divorce. Did you know marriage counselors cause divorce? There's a high rate of people who go to marriage counseling who go to get divorced. Right? Actually, it reminds me, there was the government once decided, you could look up ratings for cars, you should be able to look up ratings for cardiologists. You know, see what their success rate is, how many people survive surgery. It turned out to be a disaster because the guy that had the worst record in the country was actually the country's top cardiologist. He would see all the patients that everybody else refused to touch. You know, the other ones the doctors gave up on, so, you know, they were the ones, they obviously had a high mortality rate. Okay, so when a patient comes in and he's suffering from anxiety and trends on attention because of unhealthy things, that could be driving him to learn, but that's also causing symptoms, which is what drives him to therapy. Now, not every patient is willing to give up their dream. One young man who was suffering from tremendous amount of anxiety, his rabbi sent him, and it became very clear that his anxiety is you know, basically by him was either become the Gadol Hadar or therefore there's no point of living. So when I suggested to him that, you know, maybe if your aspirations were a little bit more realistic, maybe you could actually enjoy learning. He said, no, I didn't come here for that reason. My goal is to become the Gadol Hadar. If you can help me get there without being anxious, then I'm here. Otherwise, I'm out of here. And he was out of there. I don't know what happened to him, but he was very clear exactly what he wanted. Okay, now, very often, people who kids who are ill-treated by those who claim to those who claim to represent religion, whether it's their parents or their rebbeim or teachers, you have to remember when parents demand, when unreasonable parents demand respect, in whose name do they demand respect? In God's name, right? In religion's name. So very often the child, it'll be only normal for the child to feel that his anger is toward his parents. He attributes his anger to his parents' religious belief. So the question is, how is a therapist supposed to deal? If a patient comes in and he has issues surrounding religion, how should therapists deal with it? There's actually a lot of stuff written on it. I reminded myself as I was preparing for this that there's a very interesting article in Psychotherapy in 2010 called Helpful and Harmful Religious Beliefs. It's a nice summary of some of the different identifying and integrating helpful and harmful religious beliefs into psychotherapy. It's Psychotherapy Theory, Research, Practice, Training, 2010, Volume 47. So it has a guy named George Rosenfeld. So it brings out different sheets here, you know, how to deal with it. So I, in the fruit community, many therapists, what they do is they just don't deal with it at all. They say, you know, discuss it with the Rav. I'm here to deal with your psychological problems. If you have any religious issues, discuss it with your Rav. I don't know how practical that is, because they're very tangled together, and I don't know if that works very well. When I first started out, I thought I would do that, but I find that I don't do that. I didn't find that it works. In this article here, he suggested, he brings from somebody a suggestion of focusing on disputing the client's cognitions, you know, like the catastrophizing or always never, I always do this, I never do that. You know, sometimes, instead of directly addressing the religious belief, but even within his belief system, there's a reason why there's other people who have the same religious belief system who are not so anxious, right? So, you know, what is it that makes, if you attack the irrational cognition without dealing with the religious beliefs, some people use it that way. But another problem with referring it to the rabbi is very often they're not honest with the rabbi. In fact, I think sometimes a big job of the therapist with the patient is, if he hopefully he has a rabbi, because it's very important, you know, a psychologist is not a substitute for a rabbi, but to help him learn how to be honest with the rabbi. Otherwise, what's the point of wasting the rabbi's time? I often get people, they'll bring up something, I'll make some suggestions, say, that's not what my rebbe told me, it's not what my rabbi told me. I say, well, did you tell him these and these details that you told me? No, I wasn't going to tell him that, I was too embarrassed to tell him that. So why are you bothering him with the question? His answer is not relevant, you know, if you can't tell him the information. Okay, so helping deal with not assuming that the especially if you know the rabbi, you know, often I know the rabbi or the rebbe, and you know, I know he's not going to be critical or judgmental, so I have to help the patient become more open and honest. But whatever the reason is, so contrary to what the implication of the question, you know, where we're assuming that the person has a desire to be closer to Hashem, unfortunately, very often that's not true anymore. It was at one time, but that's the last thing the person wants now. One patient once told me very well, he says, you don't understand, it's not that I don't believe God exists. I also know that my father exists, I just don't want to have anything to do with him. You know, it's a purely emotional thing. And it's very normal, that a person would attribute the problems to religion and to God. There's a statement of Ber Mechaike from the Mutzel Katz of Shivan Tal, the great uncle of mine. So he said, he brings out a medrash a medrash that says that Yosef was praised for not going off the derech. So I guess the problem existed way back then too. Yeah, why? So he asked, why was he praised? Why would I think he'd go off the derech? So he says, because the people who were the torchbearers of Yaakov's ideology, you know, the Shvatim, caused them tremendous pain by telling him to be an Eved. Human nature would be that if somebody, a bearer of an ideology, causes someone pain, the patient would reject that person and his ideology. That's human nature. And therefore, if he didn't reject, he deserves praise for that. So it's human nature if somebody's hurt by parents or teachers, you know, who proclaim an ideology, And very often they hurt the child in the ideology, you know, yelling at the kid for not doing whatever religious thing he's supposed to be doing. It's only human nature that the person would turn against religion. Many of the expose books that they have recently published, like, seems to be more popular in the Hasidic community, the people who left write books about their experiences, and it's presented as if the problem is in the religion. The religion is too rigid, the rules are too strict, and anybody who, if you actually read the book, you'll see that clearly the parents are just lousy at parenting. They were abusive, way over controlling, even within those communities. But, you know, it's presented as if the problem is a religious problem. I asked somebody, you know, there's an organization that helps people go off to therapy. Are you guys familiar with it? Footsteps, right? So I've had a few patients who've been there. I always ask them, when they have their discussion, does anybody ever talk about their personal history, you know, in their family? Besides complaining about the religion and all the rules that they couldn't stand, does anybody ever mention it? Because all the ones that I know who went to Footsteps or were all had serious issues at home, no, they never discussed it. It's all ideological, you know, like as if that's the issue. In fact, one fellow from Footsteps, I remember, and the trouble is if you try to address it in the positive way and talk about the wonders of, you know, whatever, and try to tap into his desire to be close to God, it could be very dangerous. I had one patient who was seeing a therapist from Footsteps when he came to see me, or when his father called me, and I said, I don't think it's a good idea for somebody to be seeing two therapists at the same time. You know, as long as he's going to that therapist, I don't think it's a good idea. And then he stopped going to that therapist. I don't remember the sequence again, but at some point, I think the father like begged me to see him. I agreed, okay, you know, I'll see him once or twice, even if he's seeing the other therapist. The patient then, I've met the patient a few times, and he stopped coming. He told me he's not coming because he suspects that the reason why I agreed to see him, because I mentioned to him that I was very hesitant, is I usually don't see somebody who's seeing another therapist. He suspected that the reason why I did it is because I'm trying to save him. You know, even though I'd originally told him that, you know, I just want him to be a happy person, you know, I'm not focusing on his religion. But he said he right away, as soon as he suspected that maybe I'm like, you know, doing something different than I usually do because I'm trying to save him religiously, he was out the door. And therefore, I think that's an important point. At that point, I don't think one should really focus so much, other than understanding why religion was such an unpleasant experience for him. I think it's really, I tell the person, first I want you to be a happy, normal human being. You know, you want to discuss religion sometime down the road. If you like it, we can talk about it. That's not the point. I think that's a much other, that's really the only sensible way to go about it. One father actually suggested to me that I learn Musar with his son. That was what he thought I should be doing. He even suggested with sacred. Because he said his son has a anger problem. Strangely enough, it was only at home. I didn't think he had it anywhere else. But he had an anger problem, and he had a particular Musar sacred. He thinks he's very good for it. I thought it was interesting. The father then got upset at the school for something they did that he disagreed on. He was ranting and raving on the phone to me what the school did. Now think about it, he was giving this whole lecture how his kid has to learn not to be angry because it's such a terrible thing. So yeah, I was going to suggest I learn Musar with him, but I thought better of it. Okay, now most often the issues with religion are a projection of issues with parents. A few years ago, I happened to be in Israel at the time, and I was speaking to some rav that I know there, and he told me that he was going to America for a simcha, and that he had a Talmud of his who, for years, had issues with, he had always Amunah issues. Always talking, he would spend hours talking to him about his Amunah problems, and now that he's going to, then this bacher went to learn in America, so now he's going to America, he knows the bacher's going to come. If I have any suggestions for him. So I suggested to him that he should find out what his relation with his parents is like. His rabbi says, I'm talking to you about, you know, religion and the moon, and you're talking to me about his parents. I said, just try it, trust me. Okay? So he calls me 2 weeks later, he came back. He's a he's amazed. He said it was uncanny. He says for an hour he kept on asking. The kids talked to him about Emuna. He kept on asking, "What's your relationship with your parents like?" And the kid says, "What do you talk about? I'm fine with my parents." Anyway, after about an hour, the kid finally, like, something snapped, and the kid just broke down. He cried hysterically for an hour. He couldn't calm him down. He thinks his parents don't like him, they don't accept him, and so on and so forth. That's how it works. There's actually somebody in Eretz Yisrael, Yitzhak Lawrence, who runs our organization there called Bina Saleh. He pointed out to me once a medrash that says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Nigla L'Maisha Rabbeinu B'Kailo Shel Aviv. Hashem spoke to Maisha in the voice of his father. That's quite interesting. But there's a secular therapist who's written a lot about child abuse, and he made a very interesting statement. And I quote, it's through pondering religious questions about God that people ask their most important questions about their parents. Why did they hate me? Why did they beat me? Why do they want? What do they want from me? What did I do wrong to deserve such torture? In other words, since God is more distant, the person is more comfortable complaining. If somebody was beaten by his parents, he's much more comfortable asking, "Why did God let my parents beat me?" than ask the more direct question, "Why the heck are my parents beating me?" You know. So that's one way of distancing themselves from their difficult feeling, is by making it more theological. There's a Rambam that says what the chet of the white Maisha was punished for hitting the stela instead of speaking to it. So there's many different answers, but the Rambam in the Shmaya Prakam says because when by him showing anger at Klal Yisrael, it made them believe that Hashem is angry at them too. Maisha is angry at them, probably he's Hashem's Shaliyah, so Hashem must be angry. Hashem wasn't angry. Maisha was angry. And then he said, the Rambam says that's why the Rachaim brings it down. That's why Maisha was punished for making them believe or causing them to believe that Hashem was angry at them when he really wasn't. Okay? Matzisio Salman writes in his book, With Hearts Full of Love, when parents told their children that their Ribbono Shel Olam is our Father in Heaven, what did this mean to them? What kind of images were formed in their mind, right? So Hashem is our Father in Heaven, right? So what kind of images? Do they think of the Ribbono Shel Olam as someone who comes into the house and screams at everyone and terrifies everyone? How can you expect your children to have a positive conception of their Father in Heaven if you don't set a good example for them? Okay? Now, if somebody grew up in an unhealthy environment and therefore thinks negatively of themselves, they feel they're very self-critical, they only see the negative in themselves, this causes many psychological problems. For a reason that somebody wrote about a few years ago called Terror Management Theory. The theory... There are many studies that show that people fight to preserve their self-esteem. Their self-esteem is very important to people. It seems intuitive that that would make sense. Like, you know, scientists always want to publish new books and write articles, so they try to find, you know, to study it. Like, why should it be important for somebody to have self-esteem? Right? So this guy came up with an amazing idea. He said like this, that since, especially when kids are growing up, so what? They're helpless and very dependent, so it's a fertile ground for anxiety. So what helps them not be anxious? The parents care for them. The parents love them and care for them, you know, hopefully, and therefore that helps them contain their anxiety. But as the kid gets older, it becomes much more dependent. Yeah, I'll take care of you if you behave, right? In some places more dependent than others, but it becomes... So he has it in his mind that you're safe if you're good. If you're good, then you're safe. Then you'll be cared for. Then that this could be projected onto God also. Right? So the way for a person to preserve, not to be terrorized of the uncertainties of life, is feeling good about himself. If somebody grows up feeling bad about himself, right, then they would become, that would cause them to be very anxious. There's also a sefer here that recently came out in Eretz Yisrael called the Kaihacha Asei that talks about the danger of perfectionistic she'ifas and ruchnias, right? Aspirations and ruchnias that are not balanced by healthy emotional reality. And in there he writes, a child who's not used to hearing compliments from his parents will project this onto Hashem, assuming that nothing he does will please Hashem. Also, how can he believe in forgiveness, right? That's one of the ways a person can feel comfortable with Hashem. And knows even if he did something wrong, right? If he regrets it and does tshuva, then it's forgiven. How many houses and schools does that work? You know, all is forgiven if you regret it and do tshuva. You know, I don't, not really. All right, so it's really, again, it's hard for a kid to believe or a person to believe that it's different with Hashem. There've been some interesting studies that were done that were published in various journals. In an article in Journal of Adolescence in 1999, is an article on some clinical applications of religious development in adolescence. And the person writes like this: a person securely attached to a parent. You're probably all familiar with attachment theory, right? You know, it's a very big thing now. So the people have done studies applying attachment theory to religion. So, right, if a person securely attached to a parent may more easily assume a personal relationship with God. From this perspective, a parent is an ambassador for God, in that through attachment to the parent, the person learns to trust in the universe, which is to say, gain faith. Right? So a person's we know that the person's attachment to his attachment to his parents affects, I suppose, throughout life. His attachment to other people, attachment to friends, to other people. So this is a bit extended to attachment to God. Another article, a more recent one, called Attachment Theory, Childhood Mistreatment and Religiosity, writes like this: religions that believe in a personal God might also be studied within the attachment theory framework, because God can be conceptualized as an ideal attachment figure, always available, nurturing, and loving. In a secure bond, the child will usually adopt religious values and practices similar to the parents. Early relations with the parents affect such things as whether God is conceptualized as loving or harsh, distant or close, or controlling and compassionate. Many childhood abuse victims tend to view God negatively, such as unloving or distant. Not too surprising. Now we have to ask another question. We're talking about the children or people's natural desire to be close to God. Is that being nurtured in schools? Is that what's being sold when schools try to encourage kids to learn and daven? Is that how they do it, by trying to tap into their natural desire to be close to Hashem, or is it to win the contest and to win the prize? Okay. In fact, let's tell you, you want to see something really scary? Here. This advertisement that ran in all the from newspapers before Shuas. This year, there's a nice little ad, it was a nice colorful one in the original. This year, learning on Shuas can have even more meaning. So how do you imagine? How does learning on Shuas get more meaning? Any thoughts? How would you give more meaning to this? Amazing way. You can win one of 10 bicycles. Yeah? Exactly what it says here. This year, learning on Shuas can have even more meaning. Special bonus Shuas raffle. Win one of 10 26-inch bicycles. Okay? I was so astounded by this. I actually called the guy who runs this program. I said to him, listen, if you would have written, make learning on Shuas more exciting, I would stop thinking it's narish, but at least I would understand what it meant. I said it more politely, don't worry. But I said, how in the world does it make it more meaningful? I can't even imagine what that means. How does winning a bike, the possibility of winning a bike, make learning more meaningful? So this is how we're teaching kids to attach to their desire to be close to God. I'll tell you something even scarier. Because this guy was a young fellow, well-meaning guy who ran this program. But Ibn Tekshvalish from Bali Shema, but the Sifte Chaim explains it's not what people think that means. It doesn't happen automatically, and you have to sell the right product. You know, in fact, I'll tell you, the scary thing, another scary thing. But there's, I don't know if in Eretz Yisrael, there's a well-known mechanic called Yechiel Jakobson. He speaks in Hebrew. You have to know Hebrew very well, because he speaks a mile a minute. But I heard one of his lectures. He said over a story that he has a friend who runs a Chevras Tillim, very big operation. He was once bragging to Jakobson how does he brag? He was telling how big his budget for prizes are. That's how he bragged. Whatever, 5,000 shekel a year, I don't know, whatever for prizes. That's what he was bragging, how much money he spends on prizes. So Jakobson asked him, exactly what are you accomplishing? what am I accomplishing? I'm getting all these kids to say Tillim. But they're only doing it for the prizes. So no, you know what? Let's go. We'll ask him why they're doing it. So you tell him, listen, if you don't know by now that they're going to tell you what they think you want to hear, not what they really think, you shouldn't be in the line of work. So he said, okay, he came up with an idea. Yaakov said, you should be a researcher. He kind of came up with a nice way of figuring this out. He said, tell the kids that there's a kid in the neighborhood who you're trying to convince to go, he doesn't want to go. And they each want to write an anonymous letter, don't write your name on it, and tell them, read why you think you should come to the thing. All they thought about was the prizes. You can get orange flavored bamba, and you can win this prize. It's mamish, gewaltig. Okay? Then he told them another thing. If you go do it by the girls, you'll see it's different. They did it by the girls, and most of the girls wrote spiritual reasons. Okay? So the guy was astonished. Like, what's the difference? He says, come, I'll show you the difference. He took them to one of the places, the rooms where they were having by the boys. The madrich came in with a big box of things. He puts it on the table and says, guys, look what we got today! Some other flavored bamba, I don't know, you know, and this prize, the bamba is showing you gewaltig. Isn't it kedai to come to Tillim? By the girls, the guy, the madrichah doesn't say a word about the prizes. The prizes are in the corner. When they leave, each one gets a bag. She gives them the whole thing about, you know, if you say Tillim, what it does for cholesterol, what it does for you, and all the wonderful things. At least she's selling the right product. We sell prizes. We killed out the natural connection to God was murdered long ago. You know, it's you learn in order to know better than the other person, to put him in his place. You know. Now, even scarier, there was in one of the prestigious modern Orthodox journals a while back ago, was an article was talking about kids. This, you know, the many kids, I was specifically talking about modern Orthodox kids in that particular article, that many of them don't keep Shabbos anymore and texting on Shabbos and whatever, all the other things. They don't seem to be connected to their religiosity. So then, and they had many, the NCSY people and the Rebbeim and other people were giving their ideas. So one of them wrote the following. This guy's a rabbi, doctor, PhD in education. Runs one of the prestigious schools. I don't want to say too much because I think it's big Lashon Hara, so not to say too much about it. And he said like this. He said that since the research shows that somebody who goes to church as a child is more likely to go to church as an adult, therefore you should force the kids to go to shul. I kid you not. This is exactly what it said. Here? Other guys ever took introductory the statistics to know about causation correlation, right? But he's got that confused. I don't know if I assume he must have taken to get a PhD, right? So causation doesn't necessarily mean correlation, causation, but to him, I guess he doesn't know that. So you can imagine, forcing a kid to go to shul, that would really get him coming to shul when he's older, okay? So this is unfortunately what therapists very often deal with, that people have gone through this, and therefore it would be very nice. You know, very often the natural desire to be close to Hashem is very often has been obliterated. So, what I try to do when somebody comes like that, the first thing I try to do is really I try not to get too involved with his religious thing, his anger at God and religion. I try to focus on what happened in his life. They don't always want to talk about it because they don't see the connection. I say, listen, for me to help you, I have to get to know you a little bit. I need to get a little history just so I'll get to know you, you know. I try to calm him down, and then I try to see what actually happened in his life, and then usually becomes very clear. Many of these people who have these experiences, you know, actually their image of God is one of the big bully, like Ramatzisko Sama writes. Somebody, it's actually like the ancient idol worshippers. Their view of God was A, that there were many gods, not just one, and that they didn't have any pretension that God had any morality. All the ancient myths of the Roman and the Greek gods didn't make any pretensions of being moral. So Avraham Avinu had actually two chidushim, right? One, there was only one God, and he's a loving God. Somebody wrote a book about this. Somebody in Lakewood once wrote an English history book, and he elaborated on this. I wrote him a letter that Baruch Hashem, most people in yeshiva today know there's one God, not many gods. I'm not sure how many of them caught on that's really a loving God and not the gods of those nasty gods of the past.
only one
that
you got.
Yeah, I guess probably a little bit easier to handle. Okay. Another thing that happens very often, what causes problems with religion, it's not doctrine in religion, but it applies there too. So let's say somebody is very shy, painfully shy. So one of the difficulties of helping such people is because they feel so shameful about it, that they, in their own eyes, let's say from a scale of 1 to 100, with 100 being the most shy, they're 100 and everybody else is 1. Like other people have zero shyness and they're like over the top. So the distance between them and normal in their own eyes is like astronomical. But really, in truth, most people have some shyness. So maybe most people are 25 and they're 45, 50. I don't know. But the gap, the same thing with religion. If most people who have problems with religion were made to feel terribly guilty about it, anything they did wrong, way beyond normal, healthy guilt. I once came up with a slogan that guilt is too precious of a commodity to waste on when you did nothing wrong. Okay, so many of these people feel guilty over for breathing, for being alive, right? Taking up space. One guy tells me he feels guilty for using up the oxygen in the world. You're like, who's need to use oxygen? Okay, so when I try to help the first person see that, what is this? The other people, he doesn't have kavana by davening. I said, hey, come on, look around. You know, instead of sitting there mourning your lack of kavana, how about just do an experiment? Next time you go to davening, look around and see how many people are having kavana. I'm not saying it's good, but the fact is, the Chazanish writes that the Vaishnava doesn't expect us to have so much kavana anymore because people are not capable of doing it anymore. Okay? So the gap between you and other people is not so far as you think it is. Another thing I often try to help people, usually their major problems are benadam lamakam. Very often they're very good in benadam lachaveira. I would tell them, listen, it's very interesting. There are many people out there who are great in benadam lamakam and that's pretty bad in benadam lachaveira. Does anybody claim that they're not from? Ever hear anybody who said that he's not from because he's not good in benadam lachaveira? Somehow that doesn't happen. Right? So you're good in Benad al-Khaver and not so good in Benad al-Makam. All those supposed to start and say the Bainchan is more makbid on Benad al-Khaver than Benad al-Makam. You're more firm than they are. It's nice you want to improve in that too. Fine. So with that, just interesting, there's a book that they just sent it to me called Rabbis and Psychologists, Partners or Adversaries. I got a free copy because I have an article in here. So they sent me one. It's from my website about Kibud Av Vaim and abused appearance, but it has some very interesting articles about the whole interface of rabbis and psychologists, so you might want to pick it up. Okay, any questions? Yes?
How are you addressing the underlying, let's say, the underlying need, let's say the science for like desire, like assuming that relationship with Hashem is an underlying need and necessity for people, for this world or next, yeah. Whether it's your next world and
yes.
And definitely like we believe this world. So like let's say we wouldn't use a method of therapy. If a person had an issue with eating, right?
Right.
If a person was an overeater or an anorexic, whatever. Yeah, I'm not sure which way.
Anorexic is not eating.
It's like right. Anger, right. I'm not sure which therapy would require this, but we would try to. Yeah. I assume that whatever method therapy we would use, understanding that unless the person needs to eat,
right?
So the method therapy would be one that would make sure that he wouldn't stop eating. He wouldn't say, well, he's only not eating superficially, or so it's okay if he's not, because then he'll die.
So first of all, that's one of the reasons that treatment of anorexia is very difficult. You're right, because there's such a pressure to get the person to eat, because otherwise they're going to die, that it undermines actual therapy. I would never treat that anorexic, besides I'm not trained specifically in that, but because it puts you in a terrible bind. It's actually interesting, somebody who I know well socially, he's not a therapist, but I've often schmoozed with him, and he happens to work near an anorexic treatment place. And so a lot of from people whose kids are anorexic, and they go there, so he drives them there. He's a very friendly, sociable person. So he starts schmoozing with these people that he gives rides there. I guess it's mostly girls. And he says, it's like amazing. Most of, it's very easy to be open with them. He's just very open and friendly. And they've all been traumatized before they got and became anorexic, and it's never discussed in their treatment. The whole treatment is getting them to eat. it's not very successful. The success rate, I don't think, is very high. So it's in Hanami. But what you hope for is that first the person has to be healthy. Right? If a person was beaten to do well in school, would you understand he'd be completely turned out of school? Now, it would be very sad if he's not going to get an education because of that. But you can't let the urge to, we got to do something, right, make you do things that are not helpful. If a guy is going to die from anorexia, that's problematic. I don't have an answer to that. But I'm saying other things. You know, to say, you know, feeling, the main thing therapists need to have is patience. It's not so popular in the era of CBT and insurance companies' pressures, but you get patience. Change is very slow. It's like meaningful change. In fact, I'll share with you, there's a story with Rabbi Akiva with the stone, with the drops of water on the stone. So how do you learn shot in the Maisa usually? What's the story? What's the point of the story? It's usually even though it's only one drop at a time, it doesn't look like it's doing anything. No, but the Maisa adds up and then it makes them. I heard B'Shem of Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld, no, it's dafka because it's one drop at a time. Imagine if you're taking all that water and you would have dumped it on the rock. Would it have done anything? Done nothing, right? It would be a nice clean shine for a day or two. It's dafka because it's one drop at a time. That's how therapy is, like one drop at a time. So you can't rush it. You know, hopefully the person will be healthier. If the person will appreciate the religiosity that he has.
Wouldn't we rather that, ultimately, just like we'd probably rather a person be alive and maybe be eating for the wrong reasons. Is there any level where we'd rather a person be doing something for some superficial reasons but be doing it rather than not doing it at all?
Yeah, but usually does. See, it depends to what extent. If a person is normally neurotic, right, and is normally doing things in a manageable amount, those people just don't usually end up in therapy, right? So you leave well enough alone. Usually they come to therapy because the unhealthy way they're doing is breaking down. If a guy's learning for all the wrong reasons, usually at some point it's not tolerable anymore. You're certainly right. I'm not saying, you know, if you notice somebody learning for the wrong reason, schlep them into therapy, you know, and try to change it. But usually if it's not so bad yet, it's easier to change it without causing any of these sharp. I'm saying most of the people that come to therapy that I find, they become more religious in a healthier way. But sometimes when a lot of damage was already done, then it's just simply, you know, that option doesn't exist anymore.
For a guy who is doing superficial behaviors, but let's say he's not traumatized, he's just doing, he's going through life.
He's going with the flow.
Right, so for a guy like that,
yeah.
Is it possible, or is it better to stick with, let's say he knows it and he wants to improve, right? So is it better to stick with the behaviors and try to get
no,
into it?
No, he wouldn't need therapy then, he could learn Musar. I'm saying there would be other methods if he's a normally, reasonably normally functioning human being. Whose avayis Hashem is very superficial, he could learn to try to make him more penis vik through learning Musar and whatever other ways that having a Rebbe that he discusses with. I don't think that would require therapy. That's just the superficiality of the guy said that the Dorb of Ikvus of the Mashiach will be a Dorb superficiality.
It sounds to me that let's say a guy comes in and he can't learn it. He's so bad, whatever, he has so much anxiety, so much perfectionism. But he's still keeping Shabbos, and
yeah.
He's still keeping kosher, and there's still, no matter how bad things are, there's still a lot of the Judaism
yeah.
that may have seeped in somehow
yeah.
in some sort of good, positive manner.
Yes. Yes.
But it sounds like if you take an approach where you kind of uproot everything they've ever learned or experienced, by kind of challenging where it came from, and then you leave them in a state where of kind of nothingness, and then it's kind of your job to re-give over that in a more positive way, and maybe hopefully the Judaism will follow it, or whatever, as long as he becomes healthier. It sounds like that's almost an impossible task from the religious angle. Because even if you do somehow make him a healthier person, which sounds like a huge task to begin with,
right.
You completely tore away all of his roots in religion, and
right.
You would have to then basically start from kindergarten.
Right.
You have to start from
knowledge.
From knowledge, and recreating religion. And first of all, that doesn't happen in therapy, probably, and it doesn't happen with the rabbi that they have a connection to because they're not aware of how to do that. And chances are, you're going to be left with someone who is not keeping Shabbos anymore, and he's a much happier, healthier person, but he's not keeping Shabbos anymore.
They're usually not happy and healthy if he's not keeping Shabbos either. They're usually not much of a...
He's happier and healthier.
I think Dato from Kelm said that once they went to yeshiva, they'll never be happy not keeping it anymore. That's what they're stuck. But I'll tell you, though, it's really not... What you're describing usually doesn't happen that way. In other words, the guy... You're saying like this, even though he's not able to learn, he's doing other things, right? So let's try to preserve that, let's say, the keeping Shabbos and kosher. Usually, these people are very self-critical, and they don't look at it like that. And if I care, I'm trying to, that's exactly what I mentioned before, what I try to do. I try to help them appreciate what they have.
They don't even appreciate it, but they're doing it. There's something that's going on. They may not be aware of it.
But that usually doesn't
happy about it. But there's something going on there. There's
in fact very often
more than will be going on if you tear everything away.
First of all, in fact, very often these kids will be told. So what use is your learning if you don't get up to davening on time? But that was the best message they get. Oh, unless you're doing everything perfectly, it's not worth anything. That doesn't really happen in therapy, that you tear it out. You go along with the patient. The patient is happy with what he's doing or reasonably comfortable with what he's doing. You leave well enough alone. You don't say, listen, by the way, you know, this keeping Shabbos thing you're doing for all the wrong reasons.
I know you don't necessarily say that, but his whole idea of religion is based on, let's say, his father's upbringing and his rebbeim. And in the process, you're saying, your father was cruel to you your whole life. You're basically disconnecting anything that came out of his father's mouth from him. In the process, you're going to end up tearing away the religion off.
There are other people. He has a lot of times because of their issues they have with their fathers, it messes up the relationship with the rebbeim too. Either because they expect too much or they don't trust them at all. So, and Hakir, by helping them differentiate, just like you would do if somebody just because his parents are judgmental, then he assumes everybody else is judgmental. Helping him make this differentiation, you say, all religious people are, always tortured you. All? You mentioned this Rebbe, so then you could try to preserve. I don't think it's all or nothing black and white. I think that's how they look at it, and I think you try to help them differentiate that there are aspects of it that they're comfortable with and that has meaning.
Do you find that people are able to be receptive to the idea that what they were taught was not the real truth, like that God was an imposter?
Yeah.
And there really is a true one? And there are definitely sources of...
Of course.
Good example of those people represented by the university, Nachman's teachings, plenty of the good sources of material that exist in there.
Yes.
Are they able to be receptive to that?
It's not a yes or no answer. It's like water on a stone. Many times my patients, when we're working on something, work for a long time, they say they're apologetic that they're bringing up again. They'll say, look, I know we spoke about this 1,000 times. I think I'm going to get upset about it. I said, I'm mamish, literally, can discuss it 10,000 times without batting an eyelash. I don't expect it to go any quicker. So I said, very often they chip away at it a little bit at a little bit. And they can recognize more when it happens. It's very difficult. The gears of the Ankusa. Yeah.
A lot of this is probably on a case-by-case basis. It's really hard to apply generalizations to anything.
But we wouldn't have a study of psychology if we didn't generalize. But obviously, applying it to any particular person, you get different combinations. But there are.
I didn't really understand the answer you said then. Let's say a kid is like bean every morning, it's filling, given like every time you see filling, he's like. So is the approach, I guess, generally, you said, but is it like, don't put on Phelan until we...
You don't tell him to put on. You don't tell him not to do something.
He's already missing putting on...
Why would I tell him?
He's going in tremendous,
Why is he putting on Phelan even though it causes him torture?
He's so scared of the
guy. Right, because he thinks that God is like his father. I'm sorry, I don't hear you.
Why don't you question that, though?
Okay, that's the shaila I asked when I first started. So, okay, taking such a case, if it was that he was beaten every day with tefillin, right? And every time he puts on, he gets sick, he gets a panic attack. No, just to bring out the illustrated, right? So, who said it so pashut? That he should. That was the shaila I asked when I first started in practice. He said, more important than to be normal. I'll tell you a story that Rav David Cohn told me once. He remembers when he was young. I think he was still a bachur. There was a young man who stuttered terribly. He could literally not say a word without stuttering, and it caused him all kinds of extreme difficulties, socially and otherwise. So there was some speech therapist in Queens, he told me, who at that time had a tremendous reputation of helping people. His method was that for 1 month you weren't allowed to say anything. That was his method. So they went to a few Rabbanim. So the problem with Krishna, I point to those shitas that for Krishna you have to say it out loud, otherwise you're not yotzei with Krishna. So many of the Rabbanim didn't want to, they weren't comfortable being matarit. They went to the Gadol Hador. He doesn't remember who it was, or I don't remember who it was. It's only a while back. I think it was either a Meisha or a Venkin. And he said, Avada, he should do it. What about, why, how can you do it? Well, just as a Levinzach, because it's his life. Okay, now I can't explain the halachic ramifications of that, but I'm saying there's such a concept. Scholar in residence, whatever, in some shul in the Midwest, and they asked me if I can meet these kids. They said they have a lot of difficult teenagers there, and they threw me to the wolves, and we had child shooters together. It was quite a scene. And one kid said to me, you know, what do you do when there's a conflict between religion and psychology? I said, I don't know what I would do. I never ran into one. He said, what are you talking about? My friend is a drug addict, and they want to send him to rehab, and the only place they have for him is a non-Jewish place, who is kosher, kashrus, I don't know, whatever, Shabbos. So, of course, you would say, you're not allowed to. I said, somebody ask a shayla of a rav? I don't know. I know many cases where they said they should go. You know, so people make assumptions. So in such a situation, you know, if it's a that bad, obviously not every situation is so extreme, but if it's that far out, they have to, because it could be much like kind of, you know, there are many things. If you look at Reb Zilberstein's Svarim on medicine and halacha, and there's a section on mental health. Many of the things he says that being Michal Shabbos for somebody who's very depressed, these type of things, it could be a shadow of people's message if it gets bad enough. Yeah.
Speaking of complex psychology and Torah, you were saying that an emphasis on reward and punishment is damaging. But the Torah is complete with laws,
yes,
and reward,
yes,
and punishment, yeah, and,
yeah,
God being angry. That's,
yeah,
mentioned in the number.
Okay.
Emotions,
sure. So Rav Dessler has a lengthy discussion, I think it's in the fourth chelek, if I'm not mistaken. So Rav Dessler says, he talks about, you know, it's clear as day, it would be total apikursus to say that Hashem needs our mitzvahs, and he gets that mad at us personally because, you know, somehow we shortchanged him, and, you know, if we do an aver, we hurt him in some way. It's actually a pasuk in Iyai that says, in techte matasaloi, you got the other half, if you do a mitzvah, what are you doing for Hashem? So he says, so the Lamaisi brings what you said, the many chazal that sound like, you know, Hashem gets upset because, you know. And so he has a whole lengthy discussion explaining why they use that, because otherwise people wouldn't be able to relate to it, because it's hard for us to imagine. You know, otherwise, whatever the explanation is, but it clearly can't be that we have the power to hurt Hashem in some way. It would be like if a doctor tells you to stop smoking, you don't listen to him, so who are you hurting? The doctor. Now, a doctor being a human being may take it personally, because, you know, he was a big doctor and he's told you already 20 times to stop smoking and then listen to him. So he may take it personally. We could probably safely assume Hashem doesn't have that problem. Right? So he's totally concerned, you know, for your well-being. In fact, there's a Ben Ish Chai that says on Kasher, Yaster Ishes B'nai, right? The way a father chastises his son. So why does it say Kasher Yaster Ishes B'nai? It should say Kasher Yaster Oves B'nai. Amazing kasher when I saw it. Amazing that I never thought of that kasher. Right? So he says, because when a father's miyaster his son, no matter how good of a father he is, there's a shtickel negiyas there, right? There's a self-interest. It'll be embarrassing for him if his kid misbehaves. We assume Hashem doesn't have that issue. So kasher says kasher yaster ish. It's like when you're trying to help somebody else's son. When you try to help somebody else's son, you get all the credit and none of the blame if something goes wrong. Right? So if Hashem does it, it's totally for you and not for himself. Okay, so the reward and punishment, the Rabbi Ruchem has a discussion, I think it's Rabbi Ruchem, if I'm mistaken. He says that if, unlike, let's say a soldier gets a medal, what is it? If a soldier does his regular job, does he get a medal? No, if he goes above and beyond the call of duty, then he gets a medal. Same thing, punishment. You know, if you didn't do something good, they don't punish you. They punish you if you did something wrong. Right? A father will sometimes give his kid a prize. We won't get into now the good idea of when to give prizes or not, but he'll give him a prize for eating healthy. He should eat healthy. What are you giving him a prize for? Because the father is thinking about the kid. You know, the government, the army is thinking about the army's benefit, not the guy's. They're not trying to give chana to the soldier. They're trying to encourage soldiers to sacrifice for the sake of the country. So they give prizes for that. You know, but a father is thinking of the well-being of the kid. If the kid needs, you know, if that's a way to get him to eat healthy, he'll give him a prize. You know, so the reward and punishment is not the way it works in the world. The reward and punishment is just as a way to encourage a person to do what's healthy for him. You know, if you get a ticket for driving without, you know, I got a ticket once. I forgot my Bluetooth and I was speaking on the phone. I got a ticket. So I was quite annoyed. I'm really thinking, this guy's doing me a favor. This is really, I mean, dangerous talk, even with a Bluetooth. But without a Bluetooth, it definitely is dangerous. So, you know, he's not doing something bad to me. He's trying to, you know, I haven't done it since, you know, speak without my Bluetooth. So,
shouldn't that be like selling the right product?
The
prize is like, what
Hashem doing
without his name?
Now, I think when prizes are useful is like this. Let's say when your kid wants something, let's say your kid likes to do well in school, but he doesn't always have the energy or the wherewithal to study, right? Or he wants to stop smoking and he finds it difficult. So you ask him, would you like to stop smoking? He says, yes. So, okay, it's well known that stopping to smoke is very difficult. If I gave you something, would that help you? Right? If I gave you something, would it help you? Would that make it easier for you? So then the prize is to help him do what he wants. Not the way we use prizes is just another way of control. In those days, the teachers smacked the kid. That's how they control him. When I was growing up, that's not acceptable anymore. So now they control you with prizes. It's not to do that what the kid wants. In fact, I'll just tell you another scary story about prizes. I once discussed with Ramuchi Yehuda Lefkowitz about prizes, and he was very much against it. Competition and pride, very strongly against it. So after I told the mechanic afterwards about it, what he said, how much he was against it, and the mechanic told me, I can't believe he said that because I know from personal experience that incentives work very well. Because when I was a teenager, I smoked. My father was very upset. He offered me $500 if I don't smoke for 6 months, and it worked. So I said, I was serious. I said, oh, you mean then you didn't smoke anymore afterwards? Didn't you hear? I said 5 months. The deal was 6 months. The deal was for 6 months. It's a serious story. I'm not making this up.
Is there nowadays anything you consider healthy competition?
So
that should be encouraged.
So the Kinas Taifun Tarbe Chochma, right? Which very interestingly, if you actually look up the Gemara, there is no source in Chazal for kinah between children as used as a method of education. In later writings, but in the Gemara, and the Chazal doesn't say. Kinas Taifun Tarbe Chochma, the Gemara says, I think it's in Bava Basra, it's talking about competition between Rebbeim. It talks about Hasakas Gvul. If there's a barber in town, you're not allowed to open another barber shop, even though you might be a better barber, because you're more concerned about the guy who's with Parnosa than getting good haircuts. But when it comes to Malamdim, you're allowed to hire, you're allowed to bring a new Malamid in to be competition for the other Malamid for Kinas Taifun Tarbe Chochma. Right? There is no source for. I once asked Rav Dov Feinstein that how could it be that where the Gemara says Kina Seifun Tarbe Chochma, and when was the last time you heard they got rid of a teacher to get a better one? That doesn't happen too frequently. There they don't apply it, and for kids where the Gemara doesn't talk about it, that's where they apply it. So he answered me tongue in cheek. He said. They don't pay Rebbeim enough. If they didn't have job security, they wouldn't get anybody to be a Rebbe. Okay. So, but the difference between healthy kinah seifer and unhealthy kinah seifer, Rambam Tzitzil Salman brings it from one of the Rebbeim and Gates, I think, the Manal or somebody, is the difference between a housewife chasing a mouse and a cat chasing a mouse. What's the difference between a housewife chasing a mouse and a cat chasing a mouse? It's close, but that's along that line. The cat is happy there are mice because he wants to eat it, right? So he's happy. The housewife wishes there were no mice. The healthy kinesiphon is that you're happy that there are people around you who learn real stark because that helps you learn better, right? The unhealthy kinesiphon is when you wish the other guy moves to New Zealand or otherwise you should.
That's how you know, like, after the fact, whether I was healthy or unhealthy, but. Do you think it's a practical thing?
Oh, it's getting to the practical part. So that's the difference, he said. And the Michal Yehuda Lefkowitz said that today there is no health. It doesn't exist anymore. It used to be a time there were people that had healthy kinah seifer. Today doesn't exist. So competition today is all bad. Just two more questions, and
Well, what will drive the learning if you don't have competition?
I asked Rav Michal Yehuda when he told me he was against privacy. People tell me, people say, well, I mean, you can't expect a kid to learn Shema, you know, it doesn't exist. He says, not true, kids can learn Lishma also, at different levels of Lishma. The actual studies show, first of all, we all know from our own experience, you know, if you know that, any little kids, you know, nieces and nephews, they want to know everything, they can drive you nuts, they ask you 400 questions a minute. And all the studies show that for each year in school, the kids' natural inquisitiveness goes down. So it's something about school that, you know, because it's all about getting grades, and there's a study, a famous study about competition that shows that about praise. If you praise a child for his achievement, he'll avoid doing difficult things. If you praise a child for his grade, he'll try to avoid taking difficult courses. You know, if you get A's all the time and you get praised for your grade, why take the risk of taking a difficult course when you might get a B? If you praise a child for his efforts, he'll do more difficult things. So I think kids have a natural inquisitiveness. I'm not saying in every case, you know, prizes are terrible. Just I don't think many people realize the downside of it. They think just getting the person to do it is good enough.
And there's no way of doing, like, having like a normal amount of competition without like raising level.
It's natural. So what I think there's a natural competitiveness. We don't have to encourage it. Yeah. I remember once. Usually not, because all the studies show that the bigger the prize, the intrinsic motivation goes down.
Natural is good, like the natural
competitor. I don't know if it's good or bad. It got created, I guess. There's something good about it. You know, there's a kid who once told me, he told me over a story that he was talking. They were having during the lunch break. He was talking to some kids about a game. He used to play in his school in the nearby park every Friday afternoon. They would play baseball. So they were talking about the game. So the Rebbe heard them talking. It was fine. It was during lunch. He said, "What do you got?" He said, "Oh yeah, we're playing. We're making up another game. We're playing." So he said to him, "And does everybody play?" When you play in the park, do all the kids get a chance to play? So he said, usually, most times we play with each other, so everybody plays. Once in a while, we play against another yeshiva, so then only the best players play. So everybody gets all upset. How can you do this? This is terrible. I'm going to ban the whole thing. I'm going to ask they're going to the park. How can you do this, making kids feel bad? And the kid is a nice kid, you know, so he tells me, are we really doing something terrible? He says, you know, the other kids don't want to play. They also want our team to win. You know, so I said, I don't know if I should have done this or not, but so I asked him like this, do you guys have Mishnayos Baal Peh contest? Yes, certainly, of course, which self-respecting yeshiva doesn't have one. So I said, are there charts on the wall, you know, showing everybody's progress? Yes, it has their names on it, everybody can see everybody's progress, yes. Are there some kids in the class, who, even though they try very hard, they're maybe not so smart, and they're lagging behind everybody? Yes. Does that seem to bother the Rebbe? No. Okay. So that's somehow the only problem with baseball. Okay. Yeah. Just one more question.
Yeah, I'm wondering, like, based on the concept that every pathology is from some like history of like emotional like issue, do you believe that there's ever a place for medication?
Certainly. I often work with psychiatrists. I tell you why, because everything. You know, you have the ads from the pharmaceutical companies show you this is the brain of somebody with OCD and this is the brain of somebody without OCD. Have you ever seen these ads? They prove absolutely nothing. Again, correlation and causation. Obviously, whatever causes OCD is going to affect the brain because everything is the brain. So anything that happens, you know, one day they'll probably be able to invent a medication that if you take it, you won't laugh at jokes, you know, because it'll block whatever it is that happens in your brain when you hear a joke. Okay? Actually, somebody just had brain injury. I just read somewhere either a disease or an injury, some man, and he can't be sad anymore. He's not capable of being sad. Yeah, something in the brain. So does that mean all sadness just comes from, you know, arbitrary things firing in the brain? So everything goes through the brain. So medication can be very helpful sometimes. Even with ADD, for instance, right? Like half of, I think, three quarters of the country is on medication for ADD, either legally or illegally. But, you know, there's clearly a lot of kids have ADD just because of their life situation. Right, if somebody comes from a chaotic home, probably a drug addict and whatever else you can think of, you know, would it be shocking to you that he has a hard time concentrating in class? Yeah. You know? One, I saw this young man, and he was doing terribly in school. He was in college, doing very poor, always did poorly in school. His mother was a professor somewhere, and she was always riding him, you know, for how bad he's doing, and he's lazy. At some point, I heard from him. He told me, you know, that the parents' marital situation was horrible. The Schoenbeigers were really terrible. Wars, battles going on. So once I had an opportunity to speak to the mother, I said to the mother, "Do I understand correctly that you and your husband like have serious problems in your marriage?" She goes, "Yeah, you know, we've gone to many marriage counselors. Nothing has really helped. It's getting a little better now, but you know, it's bad." So do you think that might have something to do with your son not doing well in school? Like he went to school every day with you guys screaming in his ears, you know? Do you think it might have something to do with it? Does he think? You think so? You think it may have something to do with it? Yeah. That lasted about a week. Then she went back telling me it's because he's lazy. But so that somebody like that, let's say, taking medication, let's say for concentration, would help them. You know, it'd be nice if you can get his parents to get their act together. But if you can't, at least maybe he could do well in school. So that might be helpful. Like,
right. So it's like when. So how do you know? How do you gauge like when it's right to be giving medication over seeing somebody? Meaning, it seems like medication is more damage control.
Right.
It's too out of control. So you give medication to control it.
Well, that's one reason. Well, sometimes the situation is so bad, the guy's so depressed he can't get out of bed, then you're not going to do anything for him. There's another way. It's the opposite. There's somebody who's doing well in therapy and has improved a lot, but a lot of times it seems like, you know, it's very hard to change things that are really so ingrained. So sometimes you get to a certain, you hit a wall. You know, and sometimes taking the SSRIs are very good for that, like Prozac and these things. Sometimes it gives you, the guy doesn't really desperately need it. You know, he's functioning well and doing well. But sometimes I think it's worth it. I sometimes even suggest to somebody they do it. The trouble is because they believe that you need it chemically, they don't even try. There aren't that many studies about getting people off it. I've had people I've worked with who have gotten off it. What happens is, though, usually, first you have to get off it slowly. You have to taper off. And no matter how slow you do it, there's going to be a kick, you know, there's going to be some reaction because your body's used to it. And a lot of times people panic. You know, they're afraid of going back to what it was. So, you know, it's an art. No, to do it, but it's doable. That plenty of people did. Sometimes it just happens by itself. The guy's doing real well. He's taking money. He's afraid to get off. And then one guy, he went to Israel. The guy was supposed to send him the prescription. He got all messed up. The kid, by the time he got his prescription, it was like 4 weeks later. And he said he's actually doing fine without it. So, you know, you're not going to. Okay. Thank you.